Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to start out with a book we really enjoyed, aren't we, Rabbit?
Oh, it's just a marvelous book. I mean, how can you describe it? It's a history book. It's a novel. It's an encyclopedia. But it's the challenging project that Mr. Sitwell set for himself.
William Sitwell.
To describe. What's the title? Self-explanatory.
Yeah, it's a history of food in 100 recipes. A very bold approach to a massive subject.
And he does an absolutely magnificent job. And the amazing part about it is, I don't know if you realize this, but he has like 3 different versions of it.
Yeah, right.
So he has a version that was written for an English audience, because that's where he lives. He lives in Milton Keynes in the South Midlands, where my brother used to live.
He's not in Milton Keynes, he's next to it, right?
Somewhere close to there. So that was the first one. Then he wrote an American version, so he added Thomas Keller and Mario Batali and a few other luminaries that Americans will recognize. And then there's the rest of the world version as well.
Yeah, well.
So, and I guess it's quite
not a bad gig.
It's quite possible to plug and play these characters in there just because of the way that he structured the book.
Yes.
So it was a marvelous conversation. I do know, listeners, that the quality of the sound is a little muffled. I guess we were interviewing over a long distance, and the phone connection wasn't very good for that. We apologize, but listen closely because you're going to have a lot of fun listening to this and a lot of fun afterwards when you buy and read the book.
I think everyone should stand up and applaud William Sitwell, who has done an absolute brilliant book called, simply enough, A History of Food in 100 Recipes. And honestly, William, it's like the most exciting novel, reading this. How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, I actually wrote it quite quickly. I'm a kind of sort of last-minute scribbling sort of journalist. And I started the book in January a couple of years ago, and finished it 6 months later. So I have a full-time job. So I wrote it in my spare time, in the evening, at the weekends. I had a researcher working with me, and I remember I said to her, so how many chapters have we got to write a week? She said, you've got to write 5 chapters a week. So that was about 7,000-8,000 words a week in my spare time, and then we nailed it in 6 months. And it was complete torture.
But your day job is with Waitrose, right?
But my day job is producing a magazine for Waitrose, which is a very well-known, fast-growing, quality supermarket in the UK. So I edit a magazine for them as my main job. And then on the side, I do food-related things. So I print this book, and I do bits of television, and I write freelance articles. And so, you know, food is a great subject. And, to be honest, it was quite a fun idea, I thought, to look at the whole history of food with the constraint of having to analyze the food world through 100 recipes over time. But what I discovered in the writing of it is really that what we eat, the way we eat, tells us so much about ourselves. So really it's a history of the world through food. And Dad, you mentioned it, but you read it like a novel. I mean, funny enough, it was a real adventure writing it, discovering all these amazing stories. I sat in the British Library for quite a long time.
I love
amazing
that place.
Resource in London.
Yeah, I love that place.
It's fantastic because, there's no distractions. Everyone else is there is working. You can't do anything else. Whereas at home, it's very easy to think, I'd better go and, rearrange the furniture. dig the garden. Everything that every writer over time has had to suffer. And I'm sort of probably inherently lazy, so I'm easily distracted. But the other thing is I'm also easily bored, so this book, it was interesting to me in bite-sized chunks. You can read it in like a novel from start to finish because I wrote it chronologically and I discovered amazing themes that pick up and go throughout time. Lots of things in food history that don't change as much as there are things that do change.
But you're also humorous and witty and sophisticated, so that it's a real thrill to read this.
That's really nice to hear. Do you know what? It's funny. My mother, the person I was most terrified of the opinion of, not critics, was my mother. And she rang me up. She said, I just can't stop laughing. She said, there's just jokes. I didn't expect this to be funny. But the thing is, like writing humorously anyway, it sort of, I enjoy that. But also, there's lots of very, very funny things that have happened in food, and there's lots of crazy, nutty characters, and this story isn't a sort of dry history of the development of the oven. It's about the kind of fruitcases and the nutters who were bold enough or crazy enough to invent things and who risked their livelihoods, and some sunk without trace. Others are great heroes. So I'm glad you found it funny.
That's it's the way you put things. Of course, as I said, I'm used to you British guys, because I've been married to one for 40 years, so maybe I probably picked up an appreciation for your sort of humor. But I love this, like in the late 19th century, during a refrigeration experiment, an ice storage plant in Chicago implausibly burned down. Just simply put. And what was the other one? The first cookery show aired in 1937 in London, making Marcel Boulstain the first TV chef, period. He made an omelet, period. I love it.
Well, you know, these things are true.
Yeah, I know, but it's the way
you don't expect refrigeration units
no.
to burn down, do you?
No, you don't.
It seems fairly unusual. It reminds one of the boy at Pudding Corner in London, who reputed it was the guy who started the fire of London, I guess.
I wanted to
say something.
I just have one more thing I just have to note, is that, because this is something that I agree with thoroughly, and I'm so glad that referenced it, is the slow food movement had its beginnings in 1986 with the left-wing artsy group elected Carlo Petrini as its president, period. Petrini didn't like cooking. Of course, I don't like Petrini's.
You know, that was, you know, there were some elements of this book that I didn't think I'd discover. And I really, that was one of those things where, you know, Carlo Petrini is this guy who campaigned for the world to slow down, to take time over its food.
Yes.
The guy can't cook. But what's funny, basically, about the group of people that he came from, he was part of a sort of communist group of people, that, you know, that's right, as you said, Archie, and there's this hysterical story where it shows you quite how obsessed they were with food, because they kind of went on this trek across the mountains because they'd heard that there was this amazing feast, there was a thing called a Montalcino in the Tuscan Hills. They went to celebrate with a few fellow lefties an event called the Festival of the Thrush. And the great thing about this feast, which celebrated the harvest of two of Tuscany's grapes, the Brunello and Barolo, these wonderful wines.
Right.
But they went to this dinner, and Petrini and his gang were appalled by the dinner. The main thing that vexed them was not politics, economics, was not the process of food production, was not industrialization. They wrote this letter saying that they wanted to discuss the lunch they had at the club. They said it was a spread worthy only of an army barrack or a 50s diner. They talked about this dinner that was hideous and unacceptable, with cold pasta, inedible ribollita, unwashed greens, and so on. And it's quite funny that, as I mentioned in the book, if that sort of thing made them cross, imagine how cross they've got about McDonald's.
I wanted to interject something I've been meaning to interject it for just a little while. Did you ever study history when you were growing up in high school?
Yeah, I mean, history was a subject taught. Like one of the things, I didn't pay quite enough attention.
Now, there was a fascinating book. I mean, it was a book. If they set a chapter of this book for homework, it was really exciting and interesting. The author was George Trevelyan. I've forgotten the name of his book. I think he was related to Lord Macaulay, who wrote to Edward Gibbon, who wrote the final days of the Roman Empire or something like that.
Yeah.
But it was a pleasure to read this book. I want our listeners to understand that this is a fascinating book about food and about history, but it's also a wonderful piece of literature.
Your style is very literary, not surprisingly.
I have a feeling that if Punch magazine still existed and you were writing for it, it would probably continue to exist.
Well, that's very kind. I'll accept these amazing compliments.
And who knew when the cupcake was first written down as a recipe? Well, you'll find it here, and it wasn't the name of that shop in Manhattan where the Sex and the City girls used to shop. It was 1828, and I think the location was Boston, although that isn't entirely clear. You simply said that the lady who wrote it was a Boston publisher who published it, but maybe she was actually living in Philadelphia.
Yeah, Eliza Leslie.
That's the one.
She held court in Philadelphia. And she sounds like a pretty terrifying woman. She spent most of her time lecturing young women about how they should behave. Then she wasn't inventing the cupcake.
She told them they should never play the piano in public. Is that the one?
That's right. She said, another piece of advice is do not volunteer to visit a friend in the country. The idea of advising young girls never to play the piano in public unless invited. And she was very strict about how ladies shouldn't ever take more than two glasses of champagne. Because she said it is more than the head of an American female can bear. But, you know, this lady, whether or not she invented the cupcake was the point I'm going to make in the book, is that the first recipe for a cupcake.
Right,
comes in her book, 75 Receipts for Pastry Cakes and Sweetmeats. So, you know, she was a dude, and so she has to go now in history.
Now, if I'm remembering what Anne told me correctly, this book was first published in England, and this is...
That's right, yeah, it came out first, in April 2011.
And this is the U.S. edition. Did you add anybody? Did you add Thomas Keller for the American edition?
I did. I added Thomas Keller. I added the wonderfully inspiring and brilliant Alice Waters, who I had the great privilege and pleasure of meeting when I was in the States a month or so ago.
Uh-huh.
And I had one of those amazing meetings when you're discussing, having a conversation with someone, and this is a sort of interview as well, you realize that this is an important conversation and one that you will always remember. She is a woman of unbelievable passion as well as idealism, but also tinged with real practicality. And she was telling me about her campaign to try and get free school meals and lunches and snacks for kids. You know, one wishes her well with that campaign because it's so important that children are well fed because it means they can concentrate, be educated better and so on. So there's a chapter about her, and there's a few other chapters just to sort of keep the Americans happy. This is quite an English book. It's written by me. It's a book about the things in food that have interested me. And, you know, I can argue for why I've included things that I have. And I can quite happily take on the chin the fact that it is pretty Western. There is an international edition as well, which will sell around the world with a few other chapters. But essentially, you know, it's about the story of American and English food and all the influences that come with that.
Talk to us a little bit about fish and chips.
You read my mind.
And bees.
Mushy peas.
The interesting thing is the mushing came later.
Uh-huh.
That's right. You know, I wish it never happened. I think mushy peas are one of the terrible things.
They're a work of the devil, William. They're a work of the devil, mushy peas.
Mm. I agree. And I also say that cabbage is the devil's vegetable. The best of sprouts is the sort of second cousin of the devil. but I do write about peas in an important chapter from 1902 about the development of the fish and chip trade in London, where the sort of masses were able to eat, you know, fish and chips and get a sort of warm, cheap supper pretty readily. Whether or not we blame the fish and chip fries of the late 19th century, early 20th century for the descent into, you know, crazy fast food, who knows? There's lots of people you can blame for the state of food as it is, and not to the world today. And some of the blame can be laid at the feet of some people who actually want to defend. I mean, one of my great heroes in this book is Clarence Saunders, who invented the modern supermarket. People may say that that then heralded a sort of slow descent into mass consumerism and so on, but he was this amazing figure from, I think, Massachusetts, and he entered the grocery trade from a very, very poor family, and he was on a train one day coming back from Indiana where he was looking for a new way of doing business because he bought himself a little shop. And the big problem, of course, in those days was the inefficiencies of how grocery stores operated. You know, they had men in white coats who served you at lunchtime, you know, when you went into shop, and they were rushed off their feet at lunch and they had nothing to do the rest of the day, and he was trying to work out how to deal with it. And he'd heard there was some news story in Indiana, but it was nothing, and he came back feeling despondent. And he was on a train, and the train slowed down, and he looked out of the window, and he saw a pig farm, and in that pig farm there was a mother sow feeding her 8 pigs, and he got the idea of self-service. And 3 months later, Clarence Saunders opened the first Piggly Wiggly, in homage to the beautiful pig.
And that's why it was called Piggly Wiggly.
Yeah, and which of course is still going today. He lost the business. He went bankrupt on the eve of the Second World War, and he broke a few stock exchange laws because he tried to buy loads of stock in revenge for some New York traders shorting on his own stock.
Yeah, there was a.
And he went bust, and he was unable to trade under the name Piggly Wiggly. So, in a real fury, he started a new chain of stores called Clarence Saunders, sole owner of my name stores, which just shows you quite how cross he was.
Now, there's an interesting book written by a very famous American author called John Kenneth Galbraith called The Great Crash. And one of the chapters in their book is, the title is A Corner in Piggly Wiggly. And
his story is a classic story of a business going bust at that particular time. But he wasn't going to be undeterred. I mean, he'd made a million. He was a millionaire when he was very young. And he started another business called Cadiza, which was a sort of a bit like those arcade games where you put the money in the slot and you use an electronic hand that puts food on, stuff onto conveyor belts and so on. But his idea was to try and get rid of staff because there was such a big high cost. And the problem was that contractions didn't work. And he lost another fortune. And then on his deathbed, he invented a thing called Speed Electric. And his vision was that one day, packaging would have a code on it which machines would be able to read. Of course, no one believed him, but of course, that's how so many of us shop today.
So he was
a kind of Howard Hughes-style figure. He built a house he called the Pink Palace, which he clad in a pig-inspired pink render, lived in with a sort of huge bowling green. And he was an amazing character. And he was one of those people who I'd never heard of, and to tell his story was a real treat.
Well, William Sitwell, we hope that you're going to write another book very soon, because it will take Anne about 4 to 6 weeks to read this one, and then she's going to want another one, so you better get busy. Get those keys flying.
When I've done it, I promise to come back and we'll chat about that one. Thank you for your kind words. It really means a lot to me.
You're one of those people I'd like to spend more time talking to, so maybe we can do that sometime.
Maybe we'll catch up with each other. We come over to England at least once a year, so somehow or other we'll have to figure out a way to get together.
That's cool. And we'll talk we'll record it using modern recording equipment, not just on a telephone. That'd be a joy.
Right. We can Skype, huh?
Thank you so much.
Okay, William, thank you for talking to us, and much success. Hmm?
Thank you very much, and I hope all of your, the fans of your, what you do and the website and so on, can get copies of the book and just enjoy it.
Right.
That's what food's about. We want to enjoy it and have it enrich our lives.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I think you'll be happy that you stayed with us, because next up we're going to be talking chocolate. You may not know, and I did not know, there's such a thing as Southern artisanal chocolate, but here's Scott Witherow to tell you all about it. I actually had never learned or heard of Southern artisanal chocolate until encountering Oliver and Sinclair chocolates. Scott Witherow. Is that correct, Scott?
Yes, Scott Witherow, and the company's Olive and Sinclair.
Which doesn't sound like a Southern name. What does the name come from?
It's actually just two family names. The Sinclair part's a reference to my grandfather on my mom's side.
Yeah.
So it's my mom's dad. And then Olive is a family name from my wife's side of the family. It's her great aunt.
Okay. So this is a family operation, you and your wife?
Well, I mean, there's more to it than my wife and I.
Yeah, tell us where it started and when.
Well, We got started in 2009. Obviously, there was a lot of testing and developing and, you know, things of that nature beforehand, but officially started producing and selling in September of 2009.
Now, you're in Nashville.
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Nashville, yeah. I mean, I've moved around a little bit, but...
Well, is your background in confections?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, I've worked and, you know, kind of in both ends of the kitchen, trained in both French pastry and cuisine. I've worked in both, you know, kind of my whole life, but I always... For some reason, I always got pulled into the pastry kitchen. Almost every job I ever had, I would start out on, say, like the fish station or the saute station or whatever, and within a few months, something would happen with the pastry chef, and, you know, somebody would need to fill in for them. And
no sabotage, right?
Yeah, and I always enjoyed it, so opportunities presented themselves.
Yeah, so maybe you're just sweet.
Yeah, exactly. To me, the pastry kitchen's always been a lot more fun.
Now, chocolate and Nashville don't quite seem to go together.
Right.
Explain that one.
Well, honestly, like, I was kind of, for the longest time, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, you know, with my life after kind of hopping around from restaurant to restaurant. And I always tell people I use this analogy of people that really liked craft beer tend to start home brewing at one point or another in their life. Well, I was buying chocolate from all over and just kind of occurred to me, can I make this stuff?
So I started... You're a chocoholic, then, in other words.
Yeah, sort. Like I said, like, just because of my job, I was buying it from all over. And eventually the thought came to me, like, you know, why can't I be, you know, start making this stuff? So I had started kind of reading about it, and kind of coincidentally, I was traveling in Canada, and I stumbled upon a bean to bar maker, which I had never seen or heard of one really before.
I see.
So once I think I bought about a pound of different stuff from this chocolate maker there in Canada, and I ate every bit of it that night, and I was just like, as I do with things, I just kind of became obsessed with the idea of starting this. Kind of the rest is history.
Well, now where does this southern artisanal come into it? I never heard of that.
Kind of the concept of Southern artisan chocolate started whenever I was kind of developing what I was going to do. Kind of the part of the development was thinking about how I was going to make chocolate, and my gut reaction or like knee-jerk reaction was stone grind it, because that's what we do with grit.
Yeah.
And then there it was, we know that we're going to stone grind the cacao, which I actually sent to different grit makers, and they tried it out on some of their stone mills and basically cussed me because I kind of gummed them up.
I was going to say, you probably gummed them all up.
Yeah, exactly. Huh. But we figured other ways. But then the second kind of part of developing Southern artisan chocolate, or the concept of it, was what kind of sweetener you're going to use in chocolate, because obviously you've got to sweeten it with something. And again, brown sugar was just like my gut, kind of go with your gut idea. Then I tested the same recipes with brown sugar, with dark brown sugar, with turbinado sugar, with just plain cane sugar, and tested it out on folks, and like 98% of them all went to certain brown sugars.
Really? So is that unusual in chocolate?
To my knowledge, we're the only bean to bar makers that use brown sugar.
Yes, I guess the answer is yes, that's unusual.
Yeah, I've never talked to any chocolatier that's talked about using brown sugar.
In fact, some blogs and whatnot have kind of, I don't know if shuns the word, but they kind of turned their nose up at us and called us confections and not chocolate makers because we use brown sugar. But blah, 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 it doesn't make a lick of sense to me.
They're generally pretty snooty, these chocolate mavens, because
they're
not even allowed to refer to certain brands in England as chocolate because it's the wrong kind of cocoa bean and not as much a percentage of cocoa bean.
Stuff's kind of funny to me, but...
Cadbury, I think, is not entitled to be called chocolate by the European Union.
Everybody likes Cadbury egg.
It probably isn't chocolate.
Probably isn't chocolate.
Certainly doesn't taste like Southern artisanal.
No.
Well, you know, it's funny because we did an interview with somebody who wrote a book on the chocolate wars, and we found out all the chocolate people in England were Quakers. They were all Quakers, the owners of these chocolate manufacturing companies.
But they didn't get along. However, they didn't shoot each other.
Yeah.
They didn't believe in being that extreme.
So you decided to make your own, and you decided to use brown sugar, and then what led you to your other flavorings? I mean, how many different kinds of chocolate do you make?
And that was kind of like when I saw with like the concept of Southern Artisan Chocolate, it's kind of developed itself really along the same lines of how Southern cuisine has defined itself over the years. Kind of, you know, we use what we have access to, and we work with neighbors and fellow other makers that are around us. Like, we've got distillers and, you know, bourbon makers kind of, you know, in our backyard.
So you have a bourbon brittle.
So we started aging cocoa beans in bourbon barrels. Another friend of ours is a country ham and bacon maker.
Oh, yeah? Which one's that?
We do a smoked nib brittle, so he hangs cocoa beans in his smokehouse and smokes the beans for us.
Well, you sound like you're having a lot of fun.
We have tons of fun. Again, this is something that a lot of most chocolate makers and connoisseurs and whatnot kind of turn their nose up at white chocolate, but we make a buttermilk white chocolate.
Yeah, I like buttermilk.
Maybe we have some of that. We have beautiful packaging. I mean, there's a box which is gradually being reduced in its content, but you pack like it's like 8 bars or something like that of chocolate in a single box.
Well, we do 12.
12. Okay. My God, our dietary mishaps are going to continue.
Well, that's a good thing.
Well, now, you were a finalist for the Sophie Awards from the Specialty Food Association this year.
Chicken style cinnamon chili actually was the bar that made us a finalist, which is probably one of our better sellers. I'm not sure that it's number one at this point, but it's up there.
So, but essentially, to get the record straight here, you invented Southern artisanal chocolate.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, we have it trademarked or copyrighted or whatever the word is.
Yeah?
Trademark, yeah.
Any other brands of styles or names of your products would you like to mention?
I mean, that's about it. We've always got stuff in the works. I mean, we're building a new factory right now, and then we've had to kind of hold off on some other new stuff that we're putting out. But as soon as we can, you know, kind of get all of our equipment moved into the new factory, we'll have, several new products hitting the streets.
Huh. And how about availability? Who can get this and how?
We do a lot of business with Whole Foods. We're not in, you know, all Whole Foods markets because they have different regions, I believe. But we do business with them, Dean & DeLuca, Fresh Market, and loads of other specialty grocers peppered throughout the U.S.
And people can find out where by going on your website?
Yeah, you can visit us online. We try to keep it as updated as we can, though.
Yeah, it's
just with such a small, operation, it gets a little difficult to keep it completely updated, you know, with all of our vendors.
But your website is Olive and spelled out Sinclair, SINCLAIR.com.
Yes, ma'am. Perfect.
And do you take orders online as well?
Oh yeah. You can order. You can order online. That's probably one of the easiest ways to go about it.
Well, you sound like you're making a hit.
We've been, we always say we've been very blessed, lucky, and hardworking, kind of in that order.
Uh-huh.
But no, things have been good to us. We're very excited about, like I said, we're opening up a new factory and factory store. We bought a building in Nashville, but it's a grocery store that was built in 1890. And so we're excited to have a building built around the same period as a lot of our machines are.
Oh, you have that, too. You have antique machines?
Yes, ma'am.
That seems to be the going thing. I just read an article on Alain Ducasse, who opened a chocolate manufacturing operation in Paris. And he went and bought authentic old antique chocolate making equipment from all over Europe.
Really? I didn't know that he had done that.
Well, it's very recent. Apparently, it's all through glass. You can watch the process, and so everybody can watch it. So
that's how our factory will be here in about a month or so.
So you'll probably have tours?
Yes, ma'am. I mean, when you go into the storefront, you will still be able to see 90% of the production while you're there, but then we will have tours offered 3 days a week.
Well, carry on and continued success to you, Scott. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely not. Thank you, guys.
What did we say after that? I guess we say, who knew? Who knew this was happening in Nashville? Haven't been in Nashville proper for probably 30 years, going on 35 years. It's clearly changed. It's becoming a new dining destination, rivaling Charleston and New Orleans, so they say. We're hoping to go there soon, but we must move on with the program, so we'll be back right after a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to the fascinating story of a young lady who decided that instead of continuing a career on Wall Street, she would reinvent the condiment. So here's a whole story of Urban Zest, a family of condiments way beyond the traditional.
Peter and I have been having a great deal of fun with a new product called Urban Zest, and that's spelled H-E-R-B with a capital N and a capital Z-E-S-T, and it's the genius idea of a former Wall Street, a former Wharton MBA and Wall Street administrator, what would we call it? We're going to call you, I didn't know what you did on Wall Street, a double E.
So I did a bunch of different things, investment banking, portfolio management.
Portfolio management. And your name is, before we forget to say it, is Debolina Data, and you made a big transition, didn't you? Tell us about that.
Oh, yes, sure. So I spent about 10 years of my life on Wall Street, a variety of different roles, and towards the end I also dabbled in microfinance while at Wharton Business School, and I was very interested in sustainability, just as it applies to businesses as well as finance. And food, where I am today, is something that I've been passionate about just on a personal level. But what I once I graduated from Wharton, I was thinking of entrepreneurship, and food just kind of was something that I transitioned into, being that I was so personally interested in it. I'm particularly interested now as a new mom in the health aspects of food as well as experiencing food. So that's where Urban Zest comes in.
And you have all kinds of health features in this. It's all natural, vegan, gluten-free, no artificial preservatives, low calories, low fat. It's an ideal product for conscientious eaters, right?
Yes. I hope so. Really, that's not where I started. My philosophy behind Urban Zest is really to be inspiring and for people to be really as creative as they want with their condiments. And that's something that I didn't quite find when I was trying to look for condiments. And condiments just as a food category interests me, just because of my interest in food and kind of discovering new flavors. And so when I was looking at condiments, I didn't find that they provided a healthier option. And so health kind of is secondary. It's really the being creative and being innovative with flavors.
Yeah, what we would start by saying is that your products are delicious. No way around that. We like those a lot.
Thank you.
And what gives you the inspiration for these combinations? They're not your usual spoonable curry ketchup, curry pumpkin pesto, which is one of my favorites, a new one, caramelized apple champagne mustard. Where do these creations come from?
It's something that I experiment with. And one of the things that I'm driven by are bringing together herbs and spices, and hence the name of the company, bringing together herbs and spices and creating innovation within a classic. So a champagne mustard is a classic, but then how do you kind of do a twist on that so that it's interesting and it's still flavorful and at the same time, you know, not as sugary or not as salty? The ways I do it is by adding a natural fruit. This condiment has 40% hand caramelized apples. So, you're naturally adding the sugar and naturally adding a different flavor and hopefully a flavor that works.
Now, I think that you would probably have a proclivity towards or a sensitivity towards really profound spicing from your heritage, which is Indian, right?
Right. So my heritage is Indian. And I
so
am
you know
a large,
about spices. You know spices.
Well, yeah, I won't claim to know spices, but yes, I've been around spices for most of my life. You know, as with most Indian girls, you and I have spent a considerable amount of time in my grandma's kitchen. And she was a great cook, so a great influence, and perhaps, developing my personal taste. And so I've been around spices. I am definitely one to kind of tinker with spices, and I always try to experiment, like I said. So I'm not the one that would put cinnamon with pumpkin because that's so common. So I would want to put something else in pumpkin and see if it works. And so some of my flavors, you know, are, just questionable when you look at it. But when you taste it, you know, it works. And so that's what I want to do is to innovate and create, and that's also hopefully what I'm inspiring others to do using my products in their kitchen.
So you want people not to just eat them out of the jar the way we do.
I mean, good. I mean, I'm hoping it's good, and that's why you're doing it.
Well, yes.
But, no, thank you for that. And that's actually, that also goes to show that the flavors have been developed so that they can be kind of eaten just over a cracker or bread. You don't need to do anything else with it, and so you don't need for the condiment to be that salty because, you know, you're not adding it to something else. If you needed to, you could add a little bit more salt if you're, for instance, adding the pesto over pasta. So you could do that if you choose to. But if you didn't need to do that, then you could skip the excess salt as well. But the flavors have been developed so that they are versatile. So you could eat them straight out of the jar, or you could add them to your pasta, or you could add them over grilled vegetables in this case.
Now, they're a condiment, at least as far as they're designed, which sort of means you may not spoon them out of the jar into your mouth, but you spoon them on food that's perhaps already been cooked, and then you're just adding a distinct flavor.
Or cheese.
Did you think of the idea of actually incorporating them in recipes?
Yes. So we have developed, and we tinker with recipes all the time, in my kitchen, in our friends' kitchens, and everybody that's inspired by Urban Zest or involved in Urban Zest. So we have several recipes online. We definitely encourage all our fans and, you know, consumers to come up with their own recipes. And hopefully, you know, our recipes also tell the same story, which is, you know, how can you be creative and how can you have fun with the whole process? That's what I really enjoy. That's the part of the process that I enjoy, you know, coming up with the flavors, really coming up with the recipes, using those flavors, and then, you know, finally enjoying and sharing it with friends and really making a conversation out of it. It's always interesting to me when people come back and say, you made what with peach chutney? You made an iced tea? That doesn't even make sense. And then they taste the peach iced tea that I made with the peach chutney, and then they say, oh, wow, I couldn't believe that it would work, and it did. And so, you know, that's what's really motivating to me.
But you're not surprised because you tried it, right?
I tried it.
I love using condiments in my cooking. Right now, we have a product from, where is it? North Carolina, called Kakalaki, which is basically a barbecue sauce. But I use it in the cooking process, as well as just sort of slathering it on afterwards. And I can see doing the same thing with the line of products that you have. Now, let's make sure that people understand the website they can go to get that information.
Yes, sure. So the website is urbanzest.com, which is spelled H-E-R-B for boy, N for Nancy, Z for zebra, E-S-T.com. And you'll find all the flavors there. You can buy off of our website as well. And we also do some gift packaging, especially around the holidays. And we do these sets, like a sweet and savory set. We have a holiday pack as well.
Now, do you go out into retail trade as well?
Yes. So we are primarily in the Mid-Atlantic region. And we are in natural and specialty stores like Whole Foods and the Fresh Market locally, and also specialty stores that specialize in cheeses and breads.
Can people put in their zip code on your website and find out where the closest store is?
Not yet. However, we do have a list of stores on our website, and it's under the shop link, and if you click on that link, you'll see a list of all the stores where we are available.
Great. Well, it's a fascinating story. Talk about a life transition. I think we did. You're someone who left Wall Street and started making brownies.
Right.
Yeah. It is actually interesting. I've personally, since I've been doing this, I've personally come across a handful of Wall Streeters that are now making food.
Oh, yeah.
Pizza. I don't know why particularly food. Yeah, it is very interesting why that particular transition. I'm sure there have been other transitions, but this one is particularly interesting to me.
Well, I think everybody eats. Everybody does not necessarily work on Wall Street.
Right. and more recently so.
Now, what's going to happen in the future? You're going to keep on generating more different flavor combinations, do you think, or will you change direction?
The hope is, the crux of the company is really to innovate and to create. And so we definitely hope to keep creating new flavors that people, again, question, and then we hope to convert them into believers and hope that we inspire the same in others. Not that I'm saying that they have to be, chefs in the kitchen, but hopefully the product is easy enough to use that they can just use it to make a sandwich, and it's a great sandwich. But they're using ingredients in their sandwich that they wouldn't have thought of putting together. So that's the hope. And we hope that we can continue to innovate so we can inspire others to do the same.
So there's something you can put on your sandwich besides mayonnaise, yellow mustard,
exactly,
and ketchup. What a relief.
Yeah. I have, I think to this date, not used mayonnaise. But, that definitely is the hope. Go for something different. Obviously, people are starting to really open up to artisanal products and try other things on their sandwiches and generally on their plate.
Well, it's been a delight to meet you, talk to you, and try your products, and we wish you much success in the future. I can see exactly how this will expand into a really popular gift idea as well. And so keep up the good work, Devlina.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that you decided to interview me and, really give me a platform and an opportunity to share my story and passion and interest behind creating this product.
We can't avoid a fascinating story and a delightful flavor. So the combination was one we couldn't pass up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Peter and Nan.
And we'll be back with one of the happiest segments you ever heard on the Menu Radio right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. As Peter promised, the next product should make you happy. It's called Happy Hemp, and here is Tara Miko Grayless to tell us what this is all about.
And she's a very happy person. Watch out.
We're talking to Ms. Hemp, which is of Happy Hemp. It's actually Tara Miko Grayless and her business having to do with hemp seeds. Tara, I have to say that the convincing element of this whole thing was you have such a fun website. I had more fun on your website than anything. So that's sort of your personality, isn't it?
Well, first, thank you for having me today. Yeah. And yes, the website and the brand and everything is definitely an extension of my personality, which is definitely very colorful and very flavorful. And I wanted people to have fun with it.
Well, we are having fun with it. It's
good.
Yeah. Of course, this is right time and couldn't be better for hemp. Although I have to tell you that years ago in Australia, I purchased some shorts made out of hemp, and they stand up by themselves. I would really want to wear them that much. They're really tough, but they won't ever wear out. I knew that. Everybody, I think, thinks of hemp as marijuana, and it's not exactly the same, though it's related, right?
Well, kind of touch on some of the things that you just said. There are like 25,000 different uses from hemp, from textiles to rope to medicine to fuel. It's a pretty amazing plant that has a lot of different options to it, one being food and two being marijuana. Unfortunately, most people, like you said, think of hemp and think of marijuana, and it's kind of gotten a bad reputation across the board. And I have ended up in the perfect storm with the food world being aware of it, the health world being aware of it, and politically a lot of stuff going on with the farmers and industrial hemp. So it's a very cool time, but when I started the company about 3 years ago, I definitely spent more time telling people and defending myself of what I wasn't versus what I was. So it's very exciting for me to get to educate people and inspire them and get them to try something they've never had. So it's very rewarding for me to do what I get to do.
Now, tell us a little bit about hemp, the plant. Where is it native? What does it look like?
Well, one of the things about hemp is that it's just completely foreign to people. They don't know what it tastes like. A lot of people don't know what it looks like. So I tried to familiarize it with something that we know of in our library in our heads. So I tell people hemp is similar to the term dog. You've got a golden retriever, you have a lab, you have a dachshund, you have a chihuahua. Hemp is a really generic term, like the term dogs. And so underneath that umbrella, there's a lot of different options. Like I said, you've got rope and fabric and medicine and fuel and marijuana. Unfortunately, back in the 20s and 30s, there was a pretty successful smear campaign that focused on marijuana. And that's where a lot of the confusion and the miseducation and ultimately the fear lies in misunderstanding the plant itself.
Now, Tara, the kind that you use for your seeds, where is it grown? What does the plant look like?
Okay, so hemp seeds that are consumed it's industrial hemp, and I source my hemp from Canada. It is illegal to grow industrial hemp in the United States. We're one of the largest importers in the world, and we're one of the only, if not the only, country in the world that it's illegal to grow. That being said, I really didn't know what I was getting myself into, so I've had a huge learning curve in everything from border to exportation to there's a lot more that I had to educate myself in order to deal with another country. The plant looks similar to a marijuana plant, which is, again, why people get very confused. It's really unfortunate because it is a amazing plant.
Yeah, and how much of all this is, I mean, you sent some cards, and on your website you have a lot of claims. How many of these could possibly be true? I mean, you say that it's one of the most nutritious and delicious foods on earth, that it has a lot of minerals, vitamins, omega-6 fatty acids, omega-3. Then you say happy hemp makes you happy, improves digestion, promotes weight loss, promotes healthy sleep, nails and complexion. And well, you go on, like, and how much of this is actually proven fact?
I'm going to say 100% of it. And so I can break it down basically in terms of nutrition. It does have more protein than meat, fish, or tofu, and it has the perfect ratio of omega, which is extremely important for our diet. It also has your amino acids, your essential fatty acids, and it's full of minerals and vitamins. It's in the same categories like a flaxseed or a chia seed, which we all know about. It's a superfood. That being said, it is the most nutritionally balanced food source that we have on our earth. We've known about hemp since about 10,000 BC, and they've been using it as a medicinal option since about 3,700 BC. I will be the first to say, I am not a doctor, I am not a nutritionist, I am not a historian. I'm just a girl who basically got sick and started taking my health into my own hands and figuring out what I needed to eat. So through talking to nutritionists and doctors and reading and Googling and researching and looking up stuff, you don't really have to scratch the surface very much to find a wealth of information about not only how good it is for your body, but really cool facts. Declaration of Independence is drafted on hemp paper. The first flag that you asked, though,
was
on hemp fabric.
And
the first Levi Strauss. I'm from the fashion industry, so I love that fact. The first Levi Strauss was made of hemp fabric. And I would go as far to say is the United States was really built on a foundation of hemp. I mean, there were so many amazing uses for it, and it's so versatile to grow, and it's such a durable plant to grow. It's very resilient to extreme weather. It was going to be the next cash crop. So I don't lay claim to being a doctor or a nutritionist right. or anything like that. I promote myself as just someone trying to figure it out. I share the information that I have personally experienced and people have shared with me with people that come in contact with me. In terms of me claiming that it does make you happy, that's twofold. The first one is I do like to be a little tongue-in-cheek. I mean, it's hemp seeds. It's kind of funny. If you would have told me I was going to be selling hemp seeds, I'd be a hemp dealer. I would have really laughed. I came from fashion, so I'm completely out of my comfort zone. So I do think it's funny, and I do make fun of myself and what I do. And I am happier. I am happy because I'm doing something that I love. I get up every day. I get to work with amazing people that inspire me and educate me. So this is me redefining what happiness is. It's a feeling. It's what I get to do. In terms of it making you literally happy is because when you put good stuff in your body, you get good results. When you eat healthy and you work out, it makes you feel better. And hemp is a great catalyst to get you on the right direction of feeling better. And when you put omegas into your body, especially for me personally, for a female, it makes me feel better. It's great for dealing with PMS and menopause and depression. Good things make you feel good. So, yeah, it does make you happier.
Now, how does it come? You sell it. We know in two different varieties because we have samples of both of them. One's sort of like an untreated seed, and then the other is a toasted seed.
Mm-hmm. So I like the raw better, by the way.
So I sell, like you said, I sell toasted hemp seeds, which I say kind of have the crunch and the salt like a potato chip, minus all the fat. They're perfect for me. I love salt and that crunch, and so it's awesome for mindless snacking during the day, and it's like a sunflower seed.
I don't think I had any of that, did I, with salt?
Oh, we'll have to get you some. I'll have to send
what,
you some.
Just
and then we also
seeds?
Have raw, which is what you're talking about, and that will melt in your mouth kind of like a butter, and I think it's like a pine nut, and that one's awesome for cooking.
Yeah, well, Peter's been mixing both the toasted and the raw in with lentils, so that's a really strong powerhouse.
It does very well, but let me go back to the sort of the second part of the question. So you sell it in its raw form, you sell it toasted, and you sell it salted. How should you prepare it to eat?
She has recipes.
Yeah, I understand.
She has recipes on her website.
But I'm asking you to do it on the air so that listeners who are too lazy to go to the website will understand something more about it.
So the thing about hemp, which is what I love, is that people talk about, I don't like using the words like diet and subtraction. The cool thing about hemp is it's addition. It's a great addition to your life. So put it on your cereal, your salad, your smoothie, piece of salmon. It makes a beautiful nutty crust. Basically,
that would be good,
whatever it is that you're already doing, just add it to it.
So
That's the first step.
So hold on. So in that case, you sort of just sprinkle it on.
Exactly. And I mean, this is how much I mean add it to what you're already doing. I meet people at farmers market all the time who are coming from a very scary place. They just went to the doctor. They are pre-diabetic. They've got weight problems. They're scared. And they come to me, and all they've heard is subtraction, subtraction, subtraction. And I don't want to negate what a doctor would say or anything, but I try to instill some happiness in their life, and I say, okay, let's do addition instead. So I know you like cheeseburgers. I like cheeseburgers. Why don't you put it on your cheeseburger today? Tomorrow, let's try a turkey burger or a lamb burger, or let's get crazy. Let's do a veggie burger. So I try to recommend things that are comfortable in getting it started. For me, it was a slow, gradual process to get me to be a little bit more top-heavy in the greens and the vegetables versus the easy way to cook. I'm a single girl, and microwaves are my friends. Now I realize how important it is to go to the farmer's market and buy vegetables. So I try to talk about adding to your life, that this is an addition to your life. So, yeah, definitely it's awesome on broccoli and cereal and Brussels sprouts. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. So put it in your cheeseburgers, too. It's that flavorful and that great. You can just do that.
Now, can you also cook it like you could cook lentils and rice and quinoa and things like that?
Yeah, it actually has one of the highest flash point rates, and I think it's better when you add it to things. However, if I'm in a huge hurry in the morning or I'm caught at my desk at work, I will snack on the raw and toasted as is. But one of the cool things that I've been able to do is, as I mentioned, coming from the fashion industry, I really don't know what the heck I'm doing. I'm learning as I go. I'm making mistakes that I'm learning from. But I realized that because of Hemp's reputation, I really needed to get the right people on my side. So I've been extremely privileged and lucky to work with amazing chefs. Paul Key, that one Top Chef.
Paul? Because I was, you have it on your website, and I thought, am I reading this correctly? Is it Paul Key?
Well, yes, it is Austin. Paul Key. I'm in the heart of Austin, Texas, and that is where Paul is.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're on his menu. We're also on the menus at Coyote Cafe and Geronimo's in Santa Fe. Eric DiStefano uses us. We've done work with Cafe Gratitude out in Los Angeles. We even do work with Canyon Ranch, the resort and spa. We have several James Beard Award-winning and nominated chefs working with us. Monica Pope out of Houston is an all-star top chef. So we have approval in the backing of amazing chefs who are helping and teaching me new ways to do stuff. Bryce from Barley Swine, who is a James Beard Award-winning nominee, he made mole out of it. I would have never thought about it. So a really difficult part of my job is I get to eat a lot of amazing food.
Yeah. Well, for somebody who doesn't know what she's doing, you're doing really well.
I love food, and so I just, you know, I love what's going on with the whole, I know, I guess the term's been used a lot, but the farm to table, getting people to figure out that, guess what, there's urban farms. You can have your own chickens. Going to farmer's market, I really love being a part of that and supporting it.
Right.
How do people get some? That's important, after all.
Well, I'm excited to say that as of yesterday, we are in 12 states. Typically work with smaller mom-and-pop type grocery stores and restaurants. We also have a website at happy-hemp.com that you can order, and we ship all over the U.S. And I'm really excited to tell you my little company and my little dream is really taking shape. We are going to start working with Whole Foods very shortly. Convenient, they are here in Austin, and they're
It's a natural, isn't it? They're from Austin, so there you are. You're in a good place too for food. Yeah.
Boy, am I ever! I love living in Austin, and I pinch myself. It's really exciting when people start calling you and they want to talk to you, and it's not a wrong number. It's pretty rad. I feel very lucky.
Well, I wish you continued success, and I could see it expanding. And if anybody can do it, you can. You have the perfect personality for Happy Hemp, and we love it. We're having fun with it. And hopefully we'll see you in Austin sometimes. We keep planning a trip, and then we're getting there. When are we going?
I'd love to have you. I'll take you out for some mighty fine tacos and margaritas. That's what I do well down here.
Two of my favorite things.
And you sprinkle a little hemp in your margarita.
Yeah.
I put hemp on everything. I even give it to my dog. So if you're with me and you're eating with me, then you're eating hemp.
Well, that's wonderful, Tara. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for a wonderful story.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. I'm very excited to meet y'all and get to talk to you. So thanks for having me.
Our hour is up. Time flies when you're having fun. And we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.